Can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
Hey there. So the podcast is currently on an extended hiatus so that I can write my next book and work on some other exciting projects. But while we're away, I hope you'll enjoy this fan favorite episode from the archives. If you want brand new content to help you make peace with food and heal from diet culture, come sign up for my free weekly newsletter at kristiharrison.com/newsletter, where I answer a weekly listener question. And as always, if you join my Intuitive Eating Fundamentals course at kristiharrison.com/course, you get access to our exclusive monthly Q&A podcast where I answer all your new questions. Just go to kristiharrison.com/newsletter and kristiharrison.com/course to sign up, or click the links in the episode description. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast about intuitive eating, health at every size, body liberation, and taking down diet culture. I'm your host, Kristi Harrison, and I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, and author of the book Anti-Diet: Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-Being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating, which is available wherever books are sold. Join me here every week as I interview interesting people from all different backgrounds about their paths toward peace with food and their bodies. And by the way, on this show, we bleep out diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to episode 204 of Food Psych, our season 7 premiere. I'm your host, Kristi Harrison, and I'm happy to be back with an awesome new season of anti-diet support for you. And I'm so glad to have so many new listeners who joined us over the summer. So welcome if you're new, and welcome back if you've been listening for a long time. Got a great season for you ahead. And today I'm talking with fellow Health at Every Size dietitian and podcaster Aaron Flores. He's back for his second appearance on the pod to discuss unrealistic expectations placed on men and their bodies, the disconnect between the eating disorder community and social justice issues, why providers need to heal their own eating issues, the relationship between gym culture and diet culture, tips for bringing your male loved ones into your process of diet culture recovery, and so much more. It's a great conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you in just a moment. But first, I want to share some exciting news, which is that I got an additional book deal for my upcoming book, Anti-Diet, with a great publisher in the UK. So for all my listeners who are in the UK or Australia or New Zealand, I want to let you know that now you can pre-order my book from Amazon and other booksellers in your own countries through this publisher, which is called Yellow Kite Books. It's a subsidiary of Hodder and Stockton, which is a really big publisher in the UK. So it's super exciting. And for everyone everywhere in the world, you can pre-order my book online now by going to kristiharrison.com/book. That's kristiharrison.com/book. And you'll see all the places you can pre-order from the US or around the world. And now I'll answer this week's listener question. It's from a listener named Amanda who writes, "Dear Ms. Harrison, I am grateful for the light you're shedding on body acceptance. You offer quite a different perspective on health compared to anyone else in the media. My question for you is, what do you think of or how should one handle the many social media / Instagram accounts with hashtags pertaining to fitness, eating disorder recovery, weightlifting, etc.? I'm terribly confused. I grew up with an older sister who became heavily involved with fitness and physique competitions. She's won many national titles and can still be found all over the internet, while I struggled with every type of eating disorder all throughout life. Somehow I missed the quote-unquote gene pool jackpot, because I could never get my body to conform to such a low body fat percentage or muscular physique. Instead, I have just been punishing myself for 26 years. I look for inspiration from other quote-unquote recovered eating disorder sufferers, and many post beautiful pictures of themselves on their social media accounts professing how they went from the thin mindset to now the quest for fitness. And yes, many of these women are toned beyond belief. Some of these people have their own protein supplements, life coaching slash diet planning regimens, pre and probiotic prescriptions, gluten-free recipes, or quote-unquote healthy versions of certain foods. It makes me question if I'm doing my recovery all wrong. Is this how I should eat? Is this how I should be exercising? These women seem to have found the quote-unquote cure to their eating disorders, many of whom are much younger than me. Why am I still suffering? I don't know if I should click on these fitness hashtags because it seems to take me down a dark wormhole. Is this another offshoot of the diet industry, or is this a legitimate path to recovery? After all of these years, I'm desperate for any ray of hope. They all just seem so happy in their newfound states of physical health and beauty. I hope I was able to convey this issue clearly enough because it is hard to see what is right and wrong from today's world. Thank you for what you do. So thanks, Amanda, for that great question. And before I answer, just my standard disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only and aren't a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice. So yeah, this is a great question, and I can definitely understand your confusion. It's really so hard when people are painting a picture of eating disorder recovery that looks very much like diet culture's picture of health and beauty, right? And your instincts are correct, though, on this fitness front. These people that you're seeing in the social media fitness world definitely still sound like they're dieting and are very much a part of diet culture, even if they're calling it eating disorder recovery. And I've seen some of these accounts myself, so I definitely know what you're talking about, and it's very diet culture oriented. And so remember that the definition of diet culture includes idealizing thin, muscular bodies and stigmatizing larger and less muscular ones. It also includes promoting weight loss and body reshaping as a means of attaining higher status. Diet culture is also demonizing some foods while elevating others. And finally, it's oppressing people who don't match up with the culture's supposed picture of health. And so it sounds like these people you're describing, and definitely the ones that I've seen on Instagram in this space, are very much participating in diet culture, especially when they're offering supplements, diet coaching, supposedly quote unquote healthy recipes, et cetera, right? They're elevating certain types of bodies and implicitly demonizing other types. They're elevating certain types of foods and implicitly or explicitly demonizing others. And sometimes they're explicitly demonizing their former bodies as well, right? So they're very much a part of diet culture and not a sort of genuine picture of recovery. I also want to point out that one phrase you used was really interesting, which is they all just seem so happy in their newfound states of physical health and beauty. And I think the first operative word there anyway is seem, right? They seem so happy. We just can't tell from social media what's really going on for someone behind the scenes. So at best, you know, as people always say, social media is their highlight reel, right? They just post the things they're proud of and happy about and don't post the things that are going, you know, badly or not so great in their lives. And at worst, social media is just a flat out lie, right? It's not even just a highlight reel. It's literally made up for some people sometimes. And I know from talking to a number of folks in the fitness world that a lot of times it is a lie in order to get followers and sell products and keep up their brand, when really behind the scenes, the person is struggling terribly, you know, engaging in super disordered behaviors with food and exercise, and even using steroids and other bodybuilding drugs, which people in that world say is an incredibly common thing that nobody ever mentions in the captions of their fitness photos, right? They're selling you on their paleo diet or whatever it is, and meanwhile, they're doing steroids, and that is what's giving them that sort of like, you know, fit look, right? Quote unquote fit, because it's actually not good for your body whatsoever to be doing steroids or doing bodybuilding drugs. So I can't speak for everyone, obviously. And I know there may be some folks listening who are in strong recovery from disordered eating and who subsequently found a greater connection to their bodies through weightlifting or through other types of strength training, you know? But if that kind of physical activity is ever going to be a truly, genuinely supportive part of someone's recovery, it really has to come after a lot of healing has already been done, so that, you know, fitness is not a part of a person's compulsion to change their body size and shape. Most people need a good amount of time away from structured physical activity in order to recover. And I say that, you know, maybe weightlifting or other types of strength training can be positive for people, because I've seen that for people who are in the fat acceptance movement, maybe in a larger body and feel strong and powerful from weightlifting and are not doing it to shrink their body or just doing it for like a sense of accomplishment, right? But I would say that's, you know, a very small percentage of people are able to do that. And I've never met anyone who was truly free from diet culture who did fitness and physique competitions, right? That's a whole different ballgame than just weightlifting. That's like, you know, a really disordered world, because that world is all about attaining this unrealistic ideal of beauty and fitness that comes straight out of diet culture. And it's incredibly fat phobic and food phobic, that world is. And it, you know, teaches people really disordered behaviors, because the ways that people eat and exercise in order to prepare for those competitions is extremely compulsive and disordered and bad for their well-being. And that dysfunction is really inextricable from the competition world. You know, the fitness and physique competition world, there's really nothing else you're competing on. You're not competing on how much weight you can lift or what, you know, times you can get in a certain sport or whatever, which, you know, is still problematic and difficult for people coming out of diet culture. But I've seen people have a positive relationship with competition, competitive sports or competitive whatever regarding fitness, right? They can have a positive relationship with competition in some cases, in some very specific cases, when that competition is not directly related to how their body looks, right? When the competition is literally just about how your body looks and who can be the most ripped, that is inevitably inherently tied up with diet culture, and it's not going to be positive for someone's recovery. So in short, I just want to reassure you that, yeah, engaging in the fitness world in that way is not the path to recovery. So Amanda, your intuition is right, you know, that you have a reason to be questioning this. And these women that you've been seeing on social media, or people you've been seeing on social media in the fitness world, sound like they're still really disordered about food and body stuff. It sounds like they've just traded in one form of disordered eating and exercise for another. And maybe for them, it's a step out of the worst part of their eating disorders, which is good. That's like really positive for them that they're on the path to recovery. But it can't end there, because they're still stuck in a disordered place. And there's so much further to go in recovery in order to be truly free. The other last piece of your question that I just wanted to address was that, you know, you're talking about how these people are beautiful, right? And I think it's really worth changing your standards of beauty, starting to change and challenge your own perceptions of beauty, so that you don't see these, you know, roided out people in a lot of cases as the symbol of beauty and health or vitality. Starting to challenge what you think of as beautiful is really important in recovery from diet culture and recovery from disordered eating. So I would say follow people in larger bodies to expose yourself to a different kind of beauty. Follow the fat acceptance crew, right? There's a number of great roundups of fat positive accounts to follow that I can link to in the show notes for this episode. There's one great one by my colleague Meredith Noble at Made on a Generous Plan, and also Jess Baker, friend of the pod, who has done a number of roundups like this of people to follow on Instagram, plus size warriors to follow and stuff like that. So we'll link to those roundups in the show notes for this episode to help give you some places to start. By the way, Meredith and Jess are also great people to follow, both in fat bodies, posting great stuff on social media. So we'll link to those in the show notes for this episode at ChristyHarrison.com/204. That's ChristyHarrison.com/204. And I think that would be a really helpful way to start changing your mindset, changing your vision of what is actually beautiful. So to submit your own question for a chance to have it answered on an upcoming episode of the podcast, you can go to ChristyHarrison.com/questions. That's ChristyHarrison.com/questions. And then if you want to get answers to all of your individual questions every month, you can come join my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. The course really is the best way to get in-depth guidance from me, because it has hours and hours of audio and written content where I teach you the principles of intuitive eating and work through all the sticky sticking points so that you don't turn intuitive eating into a diet, which is such a common thing I see with people who are trying to do it on their own. Instead, you'll learn how to recognize and reject the diet mentality in all of its sneaky forms and push back on the fat phobia and food phobia that you've internalized from diet culture so that you can start to relate to food and your body from a place of true self-care and free your mind to focus on all the things you really care about in life. As a participant named Emily shared, since starting this course, I am now making steps to starting a business, and that could not have happened without the freeing up of headspace that your content has created. If you're ready to break free from diet culture and reclaim the life it stole from you, you can learn more and sign up for the course at christyharrison.com/course. That's christyharrison.com/course. This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by Made In Cookware. Have you ever wanted to upgrade your cookware to the same pots, pans, and knives as world-famous chefs like Tom Colicchio or Grant Achatz, but couldn't justify the investment? I know that's been true for me. So now you can check out the amazing cookware company called Made In. Made In knows that better tools make better food. All their pots, pans, carbon steel, and chef's knives are made by the best cookware makers from the US and France. Because good cookware should be accessible, Made In offers fair pricing and is only sold online, which cuts out high retail store pricing. Made In offers a single line of essential pieces, simplifying the process of outfitting your kitchen. Made In also offers free shipping, free returns, 24/7 customer support, and a lifetime guarantee on all of their products. I really love the stuff they sent me. They sent me their chef's knife, which is awesome. It has a great feel and is super comfortable to hold, which is helpful when you're chopping a bunch of stuff. Plus, it's so much sharper than all my other knives, even though I literally just sharpened them all. I spent like a whole day, maybe not a whole day, but like a whole afternoon sharpening knives by hand. And then I got this Made In knife and I was like, oh crap, this is like way better than any of the knives I have. They also sent me an amazing pan that my husband and I used to make pancakes. And the pancakes came out perfectly cooked. They were not burnt on the outside the way they sometimes get when we make them in the cast iron skillet that we use. We made them in the Made In pan and they were so perfectly golden brown and cooked through as well, which is very hard to get. So take your cooking to the next level today by going to madeincookware.com/foodpsych, and you can use the promo code foodpsych for 15% off your first purchase, excluding kits. That's madein, M-A-D-I-N, cookware.com/foodpsych, F-O-O-D-P-S-Y-C-H, promo code foodpsych for 15% off your first purchase. madeincookware.com/foodpsych, promo code foodpsych. And now, without any further ado, let's go talk to Erin Flores. And by the way, Erin's first episode was actually episode 65, way back when. I said episode 67 by mistake in the interview, but if you want to listen to his whole story and hear about his relationship with food growing up, it's in episode 65, which is available at christyharrison.com/065 or wherever you're listening to this. So Erin, welcome back to the show. I'm so glad to be talking with you again for the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me back on. It's rarefied air to be a returning guest. So thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I am, you know, have loved following your career and being colleagues with you and sort of seeing what you're up to over the years. And I realized recently that we had talked like 3 years ago, which is just bananas because so much happens in 3 years. And your episode was like, I think it was number 67, which is just like, we're talking now as we're recording this and episode 202 is dropping. So it's kind of a whole new ball game, and it's been a long time. And I know you've been up to some amazing stuff in those years. So catch us up on what's been going on for you since 2016.
Yeah, you're right. It's amazing how much really does happen in such a short period of time and how much, for lack of a better word, work transformation can occur. Really the biggest thing that has happened since then is I've become a certified body trust provider, and that is a training that was developed by Hillary and Dana Be Nourished in Portland, Oregon. And I was in the second cohort. So I think I did it like 2017, and I started in May, and it's about, depending on how fast you do it, right, or up to date, it's like a 9-month course of work. And I completed that. I finished like right around January of 2018. And that was, and still is, probably the best thing I've done professionally since becoming a dietitian. It really has brought together so many different modalities of thinking into my consciousness, and how I practice has definitely changed. But it's also created just this community of people that I feel very strongly connected to, because there's such a similar mindset and a similar approach to working. So it's been a huge game changer for me.
Yeah. And that sense of community and connection to other providers, I think, is so important. And for anyone doing this work, I think it can feel kind of isolating, just like for people who are doing this work in their own lives, for both professionals and people trying to recover. I think it's like the work that we're doing, the haze, anti-diet, fat positive work, is really going against the grain, going against the mainstream and diet culture. So having that sense of community is like essential.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like you said, it's essential. And, you know, the people in my cohort, a lot of us are still friends. And even people who weren't in my cohort, but are fellow Body Trust providers, like, I've developed these incredible friendships with them. And it's like, sort of like an interesting thing that I've noticed is when I meet folks and they're like, oh, I'm a certified Body Trust provider. It's sort of like, my favorite show is The West Wing. And there's a scene in The West Wing where Sam Seaborn, who's Rob Lowe's character, is moving on, and he's going to run for Congress. He's not going to be a speechwriter anymore. And the new person they hire delivers a note to, like, you know, his boss, Toby Ziegler. And the note says, he's one of us. So, like, it's like this tip of the hat, right? That, like, this guy's what he knows what we do as speechwriters, right? And I feel like every time I meet a Body Trust provider, I get that sort of idea of like, oh, they're one of us. Like they've gone through this similar work. We have a similar language, and there's like this sort of unspoken bond that I notice just personally. I don't know if the other folks notice it, but for me, I notice it.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that from other people who've gone through that training too, that there's this bond and there's this community that's really strong and really powerful, and totally makes me want to do it. I have not had the time in any of the cohorts they've done thus far, but it's really still on my mind as something to strengthen my sense of community in this space, because I think that's hugely important, especially as we all end up playing on bigger stages, having more attention to us. You know, I know as I've moved forward in my career, I definitely feel the sense of needing to check in with a community, needing the support of a community even more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I will also be clear, like, I'm not a paid representative in any way. I get no kickbacks for recommending it, but like, I recommend it to everyone. Like, I really do. I just, whether you're a dietitian, a therapist, a coach, a trainer, it doesn't matter. Like, it really is work that is essential if you're going to talk to anyone around food and body.
Yeah. What is it about that particular framework that you think is so transformative? How has it sort of changed the way you perceive things, I guess?
It's definitely the most recent training I've done. And before, like, I had done some supervision with Elise Resch and intuitive eating. I did some work around health at every size. And so, like, it was sort of the last piece within that sort of very similar paradigm. So I definitely understood the intuitive eating part. I felt like I had a pretty good grasp of the health at every size part. But what the Body Trust certification did for me is it solidified those things deeper, and it built roots with those philosophies deeper. The thing that it added was this really profound sort of social justice narrative to bring in topics of weight stigma, to bring in topics of race and oppression and feminist theory, and just like this way of looking at the issues of food and body. I remember when I thought about doing this, I reached out to Hillary and I asked her, like, we had a couple, like, sort of dialogues about it. And I remember her telling me, like, listen, within the eating disorder community, it's definitely going to be seen as fringy. It's going to be seen as a little bit out there. But that resonates with me. Like, I think it is out there. I think it is fringy, but I think that's what this community needs. And so for me, it allowed me to feel comfortable talking about all of these things outside of food that I've been trained to talk about. It sort of allowed me the permission to bring all these other things into the office that make the work more profound. It's not just food, right? But we need to talk about fat phobia. We need to talk about weight stigma. We need to talk about oppression. And then if we're going to talk about oppression, we need to talk about white supremacy and systematic racism. And we need to talk about gender inequality, and we need to talk about the trans experience. And so it sort of opened the door to many more conversations that allow for deeper healing with the people I'm working with.
I love that. And I think it's so true that really that's what the eating disorder community needs so desperately, because there is so much fat phobia in the eating disorder community. And there's also, I think, so much, for lack of a better term, white supremacy. There's sort of an unawareness of intersectionality, I think, in many corners of the eating disorder field. And I think there's, I don't know, I've seen this in like eating disorder conferences I've been to and treatment centers that I've connected with, where it feels like sort of there's this effort to preserve the status quo, or like a lack of wanting to rock the boat with the status quo, and just sort of thinking like, yeah, everything else is okay. It's just these individual people's individual eating and body image issues. And we just need to fix those things and then send them back out into the world, weight restored and with a food plan. And then they're on their merry way to recovery. And in my experience, that is not effective. Not doing the deeper work, not looking at the reasons why, the systemic reasons why they felt so badly about their bodies and felt the need to shrink them or to pursue quote unquote purity through food or through exercise. Like that's the most important work, I think. And, you know, that certainly connects with our individual experience, that connects with our psychological experience, our experiences with our families of origin. But if we're not acknowledging that sociocultural piece, if we're not acknowledging what a difficult world it is to recover into, and why so much, you know, probably 99% of what people experience with regard to food and body in our society is profoundly fucked up and disordered. If we're not acknowledging that, then recovery, I think, is well near impossible.
I agree 100%. And the interesting thing about this training was that I think what I needed to really help bring it into the room and be confident in talking about it was being able to do my own exploration into what it means for me. And I think that was, you know, it's not just like language, right? It's not just, oh, here's what these things mean, right? Or here's what intersectionality is. It's really what I sort of appreciated about this training is that it gives you space to like do all that sort of internal work first, so that you can really sort of see what it's like, right? Really like do your own body trust work so that you can help someone else do that similar sort of type of work. And I think many other trainings don't do as much work on like your own self and helping heal ourselves before we even like start to work with other folks. And I'm thankful for that space.
Yeah, that is so rare. And I wonder why that is, that other trainings don't acknowledge that as much. I feel like it's almost seen as like, you do that work in therapy first, and then you come here and learn how to teach other people. But this idea of having it integrated and having the awareness of like, yeah, in reality, most of us are wounded healers. We've been through this ourselves and probably have some vestiges of it that we're still working through. And so like, it sort of doesn't make any sense not to acknowledge it. We need to bring that into the space and bring that into the room and heal that.
Yeah, I know. I would say, one of the things I'm really thinking about recently is that being one of the major flaws in our eating disorder community is the lack of support for people doing the work and helping people and like, oh no, just support yourself like outside of this and hopefully you'll be okay.
Right. And what a silly thing that is, given that,
right,
you know, the work we're teaching other people to do is like ask for help and build a support system and get the help you deserve. And then once we reach some sense of recovery, it's like, okay, well, you're on your own, which is just not true. That's not how it is. And we're all ever-changing, ever-evolving human beings that have different needs throughout our life cycles. And we need to like acknowledge that and have support for that.
Absolutely.
That brings me to another thing that you've been up to since our last talk, which is that recently you started a provider support group with Rachel Milner. I'm curious to hear more about that and how that came about.
Yeah. So Rachel Milner is a psychologist. She's in Philadelphia. She's a fellow body trust provider. She was in cohort one. And again, we met through body trust. And we have developed this friendship, and we have just sort of recurring talks every month or so where we just sort of hop online and chat with each other. And one of the things that we were noticing was this idea of there are so many of us doing this work who have our own histories with eating disorders and disordered eating and body image and, you know, struggling with being connected in our body. And yet we're doing this work, and really there's no space to like talk about what we're currently struggling with. And it's sort of understanding that we can move through our eating disorder and recover, but that doesn't, once you pass that threshold, right, it doesn't mean you might never go back. You know, there could be things in life that come up and are going to really trigger you or send you, you know, in the other direction from, and go back to maybe where you used to be. So where does a clinician go to talk about it? And so many, we were just hearing so many people say, like, you know, I can't go to this support group. Like, I can't go here because the therapist that I refer clients to is there. The clients are there. It's just, there's no safety for me. So we just talked about it more and more, and we realized, let's start our own provider support group. And it really just sort of, you know, I think one of us said it and we were like, yeah, we should do that. And then within, I don't know, I would say a month, we launched it. You know, it's like it really sort of happened that quickly. And what we're doing is we're meeting every other Sunday night, and we meet virtually, and we are really providing a space to support each other. There's really no agenda with each group. It's really just sort of what shows up, and let's talk about it. Let's support each other through it.
I love that. I think that's so necessary, especially because I think I mentioned this on the podcast a few episodes ago, and probably it'll be months ago by the time this comes out, but about Shira Rose, who's a therapist, an eating disorder therapist, who publicly opened up about her own relapse and going to eating disorder treatment and how fat phobic that eating disorder treatment has been. And this sort of, I think, brought the spotlight a little more onto the idea that clinicians can still struggle with this stuff, and that people who are working in the eating disorder treatment space with their own histories of eating disorders can still be in process themselves with this stuff. And that, like, how sad is it that it would have to get to that point of relapse that, you know, she ended up needing to go to residential and having this awful experience at residential. But what if along the way she could have had more support that maybe could have headed off the eating disorder relapse in the first place?
Yeah. And what's interesting is for how public that story has become, how many are unspoken, and like the bravery to sort of come up and say that out loud as someone in our community is so important, right? And how really, like, it's groundbreaking on some level, because it sets the stage for, like, if we're asking people to be vulnerable in our office, we need to also, like, we're human. There is humanity on both sides of this equation. And bringing that vulnerability to this is hopefully going to change how we think about providing support for clinicians.
I really hope so, because I think now there's this sense of, like, I can't, like you said, you know, oh, I can't go to this support group because there are people there that I would be referring to, or there's clients there. But also, like, at a deeper level, like, what if other providers found out that I'm struggling? Is nobody going to refer to me anymore? Am I going to have to, like, take a break from this work to do my own healing? And what does that mean for my ability to support myself and my family? And, you know, all of these really sort of scary questions about being able to provide for yourself and take care of yourself through your career, and having your career be tied up with something that has previously been a source of struggle that you thought you had totally recovered from, and then turns out you end up struggling again, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like there's sort of a lack of humanity, like you said, in this idea that eating disorder treatment professionals who are recovered should just be recovered and that's it forever, and you're never going to struggle again. And if you do, then you have to, like, it's shameful, you can't talk about it, and you have to, like, deal with it on your own and not be supported by this community, and, like, sort of lose your ability to do this work, basically. And I feel like that's not, in no other field really would that be the case. I feel like there's sort of a specific thing with the eating disorder community that makes that such a high bar. But, you know, if someone is treating, like a therapist treating people for anxiety and has their own anxiety issues, I feel like it's sort of, there's more of a sense of like, well, of course you're going to ask for help. And of course you can still like take care of yourself and work through your own stuff while having this practice too. Like it doesn't have to be this black and white thing, but somehow for eating disorders, it's so black and white.
I totally agree. And it, like this idea that like, to working with someone, you can't struggle at all is, it's very like black or white eating disorder thinking. Mm-hmm. Like, really, why are we thinking that? Like, it's just, it's so, I don't know, it's so contradictory to what we talk about with our clients about finding the gray area and finding the middle ground and finding like these nuances within this work.
Yeah, even the term recovered, you know, I think I've been using that term now, and I do identify as recovered myself, but I feel like there is this spirit of in process that is missing. And so I see why people will often say in recovery, even though they haven't used behaviors or been in eating disorder mindset for years, because, you know, there's this sense of like, it's an ongoing process. And I think that's this idea of like recovered forever is really problematic. And also I can see how like people who are struggling want to aspire to that. It gives you something to hope for. Like, okay, I can actually get to a place where this is not a force in my life anymore and it's not affecting my day-to-day living. And that is true and that's possible. And it doesn't mean that you're going to get there and then never struggle ever in your life again.
And I agree. And I think if you invite me back for a third time, we could have a whole conversation about recovered and like, because both words bother me and I can't articulate really why yet, but they both bother me. And because it's my initial thought is just like, we think of it as like, for the clients who are working on their recovery, they're like, when do I get there? How do I know I'm there? Right. And like, how do I know I'm recovered or in recovery? Where is the threshold? Right. And it's again, it's sort of the definition is so, I don't know. I think it's based on a lot of things that we find problematic. So I think maybe we need a different word, but I don't know what that word is. And I don't know what it looks like yet.
Yeah. Well, I love that idea that, you know, sort of thinking about a different word altogether and a different something that's not built on that binary, that sort of false black and white dichotomy. Because yeah, in recovery doesn't feel totally right to me either. Like there's something problematic about that too. Saying that you're perpetually in recovery or that you're trying to aspire to a recovered state, but how do you know when you get there? Ugh, it's all, yeah, very tricky. And then there's the thing of eating disorder versus disordered eating and that piece of,
yeah,
right? Like I think a lot of people who have disordered eating, chronic dieting, internalized weight stigma leading them to use disordered behaviors with food that are not clinically diagnosed as an eating disorder. And in some cases, maybe could be if they were not subjected to fat phobia from providers. But, you know, in some cases, maybe it's still sub-threshold. I think people who are in that space where it is kind of, it feels more gray, don't tend to use the word recovered or recovering so much. I think that those are sort of words in like the clinical eating disorder space, but I feel like there needs to be something there as well. And I often will say like healing or breaking free from diet culture or something like that to sort of communicate what that process looks like. But really it's all of a piece to me. It's all the same process, whether it's clinical eating disorder or disordered eating. And I don't even harp on the distinctions between those because it just doesn't, people are struggling and suffering no matter what.
Right. I think that's the main, I love that last line too. It was like, who cares what we call it? People are struggling. People are hurting, you know? And the one thing I remember Marcella Raimondo told me at one point was, part of the reason we have such a hard time classifying some of these folks with their eating disorder is because, you know, we're using this criteria. Again, it's based in white supremacy, and the DSM-5 is probably not very inclusive in a lot of ways. And so why, like the tool itself is flawed, right? So like, of course, it's hard to find some of the answers and have people sort of identify where they might quote unquote fit.
So tricky. So yeah, I'm curious with your own practice, because you are certified body trust provider, health at every size, like that's the focus of your private practice. And then you also work in an eating disorder treatment center too. And I'm curious how the approaches might differ there, or the sort of how you navigate the difference in those sort of environments.
It's a really good question. So I work part-time at Center for Discovery, and there's locations all over the country, right? I work in Woodland Hills, which is a outside here suburb here in LA. And when I joined back in, it's over 2.5 years now, they hired me, one, to be a dietitian in one of their treatment centers, but two, to also be one of the voices that helps develop a binge eating disorder specific program for them. And I remember when I interviewed, I was like, I'm happy to do this. This is so needed. I would love to do it. But if it's not health at every size, and if it's not consistent with the philosophies that I work with, I won't do it. Like I can't do it. I'm not going to get a paycheck and compromise any of my philosophies to do this work. And they were like, no, we want to do it this way. We want your voice here. We want the influence of these things. And what I found is Center for Discovery has done a really, from my perspective, both from a part-time being inside and outside of it, is done a lot of work to try to make sure that they are aligned with health at every size throughout the company. And that's a daunting piece of work. And it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but there are a lot of conversations within the company about how do we really further this work. So it's not just for in our binge eating disorder program, right? But it's actually throughout all of the eating disorder treatment, residential, outpatient. And I'm happy to be a part of that conversation. We have a Hayes Advisory and Inclusivity Board that meets, and we talk about these issues. We spend time thinking about as we relook at policies and how we do things as a dietitian from the dietary perspective, how can we do better? And so there are a lot of conversations that happen within that company that I'm very proud of. And there is a willingness to try and do it and realize we're going to fuck up and that it's not going to be perfect. But one of the things that I think I've already seen is that when those things do happen, people are doing a really good job of listening instead of like getting defensive and throwing someone under the bus, like, oh, it was just a marketing issue or whatever. We're sort of saying like, no, it was a problem. It shouldn't have happened. And here's what we are doing to both listen to the concerns, but also do better moving forward. And the hope is that if we can show that a company the size of Center for Discovery can create a health at every size eating disorder treatment center that others will follow. It has the potential to, and again, maybe I'm drank the Kool-Aid too much or something, which is fine, but like, I think it has the potential to have a profound impact on the eating disorder community. And if that's the case, like, I want to be a part of that. Like, I want to be a part of the rebellion that helps change how these things happen.
I love that. And I mean, from where I sit outside of that organization or outside of any eating disorder treatment center, I really do think that Center for Discovery is pushing the envelope in a lot of really great ways, and that being a national or maybe even international, I don't know, at least national, right?
Yeah.
Company with, you know, centers across the country being so huge and having to have this sort of like centralized approach to things, but also having hundreds, thousands of individual providers working at all of the centers and having their own philosophies and things they bring to the table. Like, it is a beast. It is like a mammoth ship to have to turn around. And I think that's what gets a lot of the other national eating disorder treatment organizations kind of caught up too, is like, there's so much unquestioned fat phobia, diet culture, just sort of at the basis of what they do, that it's hard to undo that. Or even for some centers, you know, for some large treatment centers, like, I won't name any names, but the ones that have a so-called obesity track or weight management track for like the people with binge eating disorder can do this binge eating disorder treatment and then go right into our weight loss track. It's like so structurally encoded in what they do that it's impossible, or feels impossible at least, or very, very difficult to untangle that. So I think it's very cool to see like a model of a treatment center that is really walking the walk and really trying to get the lingering diet culture out of its system.
Yeah, it is. It's going to take a lot of work. And, you know, I think the thing that is really interesting is, as you think about, I don't know if you've ever worked in a treatment center, but like the level, the sheer number of people who interact with one client is daunting. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that on a national level, right, there's a lot of folks that you need to really sort of like educate if they don't know about health at every size, like give them that space to do some work, really inform them about what this means and trying to internalize it on their own way, right? Just like the body trust work we talked about a little bit earlier, right? Is how do you give space to folks who might come into this and be like, a health at who? They've never heard of it, right? But they still want to work at Center for Discovery. And so it's a big job, but I think we're really excited to do it and to literally like dive in the pool and just do it.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge. And I think you're right that it has to be helping people with their own issues with food and body stuff, but their own internalized fat phobia as well, their own internalized diet culture beliefs about food, helping people untangle that so that they can then go on and do this work in a way that's not doing harm is so important.
Absolutely.
That's part of why I do this podcast too, is that I sort of started doing it for just the general public and then developed this robust kind of side audience of, or not side audience, but like segment of the audience that is actually professionals doing this work. And I think that says a lot, actually, that so many professionals have come to the podcast. I'm sure yours too, because it's, you know, specifically for dietitians and other professionals. But like, you know, the fact that there is this huge segment of my audience really speaks to the need for me of like having resources for people, for providers to do their own work.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So yeah, that's really awesome that you're doing that. And then another piece of your recent work has been this men's body trust focus. So I'm curious to dig into that piece and talk about, you know, obviously you are a man, so like, you know, your identity probably helps shape the desire to do that. But how have you started to bring body trust into your work with men specifically? And what do you think? What do you see among men who struggle with this stuff as kind of like the largest areas of struggle with respect to food and body image?
So, you know, I thought of doing this group really because, again, just like the conversations I had with Rachel and doing a group for providers, I mean, the need is so high and there's no other body trust group that is focused on just men. There's a lot of body trust groups out there and there's a lot of different even men's groups out there. I mean, less for body image for men, but like there's really, this is like sort of the unicorn of them. So I was like, I just got to do this. Like, I think it's, there's, you know, hopefully like it can just sort of take off. And I've run it twice and I've had, you know, like I would say between 4 and 6, 7 people participate each time. So the need is definitely there. And the group is open to anyone who identifies as male, right? So I'm happy to have trans men join. I'm happy to have cis men join. Wherever they fall on that gender identity, I'm happy to have them. And what I found is this, is that with my very small N so far, not a whole lot of folks, but the commonality is this, is that there's really no space where they've been able to talk about what it feels like to be in their body and like genuinely what it feels like to be in their body or how scary it might be to be in their body. And so many of these things get wrapped up in, you know, masculinity, athletics, what is health, what is an acceptable body for them, aging, many of the same factors that might affect women. It, obviously, some things are going to be a little bit different, but there's so many like commonalities. And like, again, there's just no space to sort of explore it. And one of the things that I found really interesting is so far, most of the people who've participated have been cis and white and living in larger bodies. I've had a couple trans men and a couple queer men participate. And the interesting thing, and my theory through some of this, is when those folks are living in larger bodies, they've navigated this world with a lot of privilege in many ways. And being in a larger body is not a privilege. It's a marginalized status. And when they've navigated the world with, in a fairly easy way with respect to race and gender, to now be struggling in body, there's almost like no tools or resilience or ability to understand or know what it feels like to be marginalized. as like, well, I don't know what to do when like I feel like this because I've never really experienced it. And now I need to like work through all of these feelings of like not being seen or like fear of being seen and feeling invisible and feeling like an outcast and judged and not given a seat at the table because of the size of my body. And so to me, like that's been a really interesting sort of theory that I'm kicking around in my head about like, how do we develop that sort of tools to deal with that kind of shame around our body and heal that part?
Right. And that is such a great point that like cis white men probably had no ability to develop that resiliency growing up, you know, in childhood or adolescence or whenever, all the times that women and people in other marginalized identities sort of end up experiencing that, you know, and people, I mean, really from such a young age, there's so much racism in our society. There's so much ableism. There's so much sexism. There's so much transphobia that people in those groups, I think, really start to have to develop that resiliency at an early age and these very almost intuitive skills for navigating the world and keeping themselves safe. And so, you know, men in larger body or men, especially probably men who've come into larger bodies maybe later in life and didn't have to, you know, go through those younger years dealing with it. It's probably extreme, like a slap in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I've been so like really thankful that people have really embraced these conversations. You know, some of the people who joined the group like had never heard of any of this. And it was like their first time diving into any of these topics. And some people had known about it already and done some previous work. Either way, like there was like this space for just sort of talking about the real issues of being a man and having issues with food and body and how do we navigate that and how do we make it better and being able to see like the fat phobia that we have internalized and how hard it is to change that.
What do you think are some specific ways that shows up for men, like how they experienced internalized fat phobia or external fat phobia in ways that might be more specific to men than to women or other genders?
I think athletics is always really interesting in how men are connected to their bodies. And for the men that sort of grow up as athletes, like it's sort of like, that's a part of masculinity, right? Is how like, how far can you throw? How fast can you run? How much can you lift? All these things. And as they're especially like, oh, but like I couldn't ever get faster, right? Or I couldn't ever lift more than X, right? Because of this is just how my body is. But then that message within athletics of like, but you better train harder. Have you cut weight doing this, Rhett? Or, you know, all the fat phobia that shows up in sports and athletics is really interesting. I mean, if you watch a football game, a basketball game, a baseball game, or even the Olympics, right? The first thing they report is their height and weight. I don't know why I need to know how tall Michael Phelps is and how much he weighs. I don't think it's really important. And I don't care if Bryce Harper weighs blank, right? And or how tall he is. What I care is, can he hit the ball?
Right.
And these are like reported and they're scrutinized. And the more you get into athletics, right? It's like you're watching people really like their body is highly scrutinized over how it looks and how it performs. And so like, for some folks, they're sort of comparing their body to that. And as they age, like, well, I used to be able to do this in high school. Now I can't even, now I'm 30 and like, I can't run the way I used to, or I can't play soccer the way I used to. Like all of these things show up. So I think that to me, sports and athletics is a really interesting perspective that comes in to it. The other part is hearing men, and I think this is a commonality between genders, but the uncomfortableness or the uneasiness about, will someone love me in this body? Will I be attractive to someone in this body? And I think, listen, I will be the first to say men have much more leeway in this area than women. We have a wider range of acceptable body types, especially around what's sexually attractive. But still, it's this really, even if you fall within that sort of range, it's still like, whoa, but like, I don't have a six pack and I'm not like, my body doesn't quite look what I think it should look like or what it used to look like. I think that's interesting. There's one book I want to recommend if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
and it connects all the things, is when I was doing my body trust work, you have to do some book reviews. And I wanted to read a book around male body image. And it really informed how I thought about doing these groups. And it's a book called Manhood, The Bare Reality. And it's this book that is, the author is Laura Dodsworth. And it's really, I think she's just the photographer. But it's a book, and 100 men took pictures of themselves naked, or someone took a picture of them naked, right, from the belly button to their thigh. So it's a book of 100 men and their penis. And then they write an essay about their body, and they write about their penis, and they write about sexuality, and they write about all those things related. And to me, when I read that, what landed for me is how so many of these men were like, one, completely uncomfortable with what their body looks like, especially with the size of their penis, right? And how much that tied to their masculinity and how they felt like a man. The other thing is, almost all of them talked about how they learned to, like, there's a lot of talk around sex, but and they talk about the way they learned to perform in the bedroom was through pornography, and how pornography shapes so much of what men think of as how to perform in bed, how to treat someone in bed, how long you should last in bed, the size of your penis, like all of these things. Like, this is what so many of these men talked about. Like, this is what I learned. This is how I learned all this stuff. But like, that's not reality. That's not really how it should be. So it's like, how do I relearn that? So to me, it just really, what I loved about this book is, one, how uncomfortable it made me, because that's a sign of where I need to grow. But two, how much of what men are taught about masculinity and how to be a man and is taught through movies, pornography, superheroes, video games. And it's really not, I think there's less through lived experiences of seeing men be vulnerable. And so I wanted to create a space where men can be vulnerable.
I love that. And that is, just breaks my heart to think about men being so, you know, feeling so terrible about themselves in comparison to these standards that were just foisted on them by patriarchy.
Yeah.
And that I think it's kind of similar to a lot of women's body image issues. And of course, like non-binary folks, and I'm using men and women in a trans inclusive way too. But, you know, I think women's body image issues are talked about so much more. And we have a sense of like, oh yeah, women face these really unrealistic ideals that other women or non-binary people and men who are in a relationship with someone who is female identified, like, don't criticize women's bodies the same way they criticize, you know, we criticize our own bodies. But it seems like it's sort of the reverse here too, that with men, there's these sort of esoteric ideas about like what it means to be a man and how you should perform in bed and what your body should look like or what it should be able to do. And that's, to me, I feel like when I have men in my life express little glimpses of that, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, that's not important, you know? And I think it's just really interesting that there's a similar kind of way in which unrealistic standards are being foisted on men by patriarchy again. And that's one way in which patriarchy hurts men in its own way.
Yeah. No, and I love that you brought that up, because that's something I will say all the time. And people are like, why are we talking about patriarchy? I was like, you don't have to be female to be affected by patriarchy, right? Like, it affects everyone in different ways, but like it does have a negative effect on men. And this is exactly how.
Yeah. And I love your phrase, smash the waitriarchy. Like,
yeah, thank you.
That's really awesome. Like, how did you come up with that? And what does that mean to you?
Actually, it was a friend of mine, artist, drew it and was sold it at a eating disorder like fundraiser here in Southern California. And I saw it and I was like, if no one buys this, like, I'm going to buy it and make it a part of my business. And she was like, great. So yeah, so I sort of bought it from her and had been trying to figure out like how to like sort of use it in a bunch of different stuff. But yeah, I love that sort of idea of like, the waitriarchy is like the standard of weight, right? And how much weight is the marker for which we define our value and our existence in this world. And if we could change that, what impact would that have on all of us?
And the way patriarchy really does affect everyone.
100%.
It's cool that you're bringing this resource to men and people, you know, anyone male identified or masculine, because I think there is like this specific, there's specific pressures that are put onto masculine folks. Those of us who are feminine don't really see as intimately and don't, and there's not as much conversation about those things too. I feel like just what you were describing about the men in your groups, it sounded to me like, you know, these guys were sort of locked into their own private shame. And there's not as much, I mean, there really is not a space for, other than this group that you're talking about and some of the other body image groups you mentioned, but there's not really like, men aren't speaking out about this in a big way. I just had Jeff Iovannoni on the podcast recently talking about why there's a need for a gay men's body liberation movement. And he's really speaking out about this from a gay male perspective and like blowing the lid off of these unrealistic body standards for gay men. But I feel like there's not as much talk about this for, you know, men in general and for all the different types of men that there are, trans men, cis men, and straight men, gay men, queer men, whatever.
Right. And I think what is so important is as we develop, I think what's necessary, this is like Kristen Neff's stuff, but like what's necessary for that self-compassion is to see our common humanity and to know that, like to actually say, like, I'm struggling with this, and someone else to hear you and say, like, I'm struggling with this also. Like, this is my similar lived experience. There's something really important in that.
Yeah, it really dissipates that shame to be able to be open and vulnerable.
Yeah.
A question that I often get actually from women or from people in general who are in relationships with men is like, how do I support the men in my life through their own body image struggles, maybe while I'm also recovering? And also sort of a corollary of that, which is like, how do I get the men in my life off my back when I'm trying to recover?
Yeah. Those are two different sort of scenarios, right? I would say for supporting men as like, if they're doing their own sort of work or at least curious about how maybe their partner's work might be sort of affecting them, right? Like I know when I did a lot of this, my partner, she sort of had to come along with me, right? I mean, like it was important that it was a parallel process, you know, even though it was different, right? But it was a similar sort of experience. And I think one of the things that is I love is this idea of creating spaces where we can really share what's going on in our head. Again, I steal this from Brené Brown, but like, what is the shitty first draft that's coming up around your body? It might not be all the time, but like creating a space where like the shitty first draft in my head right now is the reason we are not like holding hands as much is because you must be embarrassed to be seen with me. And a man can say that, right? I mean, I think they can say like, I'm worried that because I've gained weight, you don't want to be with me anymore. You don't think I'm as attractive and you don't think I'm not the person you want to be with anymore. That's the shitty first draft that I'm saying in my head. And somehow giving space for that like initial conversation to me hopefully creates a relationship that is really open and where people feel seen and heard. I also think things like podcasts, your podcast, my podcast, anyone's, right? But I think there's something about like saying like, hey, I listened to this. Would you mind like taking 35, 45, an hour out of your week and just listening to it? Like, I think it's really important. I think there's some things in there that I'm experiencing that maybe we can talk about. And I think it's things like that where you bring in the conversation, like, this is what I'm working on. Like, this is what I'm curious about. Do you have any feelings, experiences with this?
Yeah, giving them the space to talk about it too, because
right.
I think, yeah, if I think those folks who are women, femmes, who are in relationships with men can probably help really open the door, because men are not typically given that kind of freedom to talk about their feelings, you know, especially people
right. Assigned
male at birth, socialized male. It's like you're really not conditioned to have those vulnerable conversations. And so setting the stage by saying like, can we listen to this together? Or like, here's an article I'd like you to read, or can we read this book together and talk about it? Giving maybe sort of a tangible entry point into a conversation could be really helpful.
Absolutely. And I think those things are just literally like icebreakers, right? They're literally like conversation starters. And I think the more we make space for those conversations in our everyday life, I think the better, especially with the people that we're closest with, I think that's incredibly helpful.
So important. What about that other piece of like, because I think that if someone has a man in their life who is sort of on their back about their weight or constantly talking about his diet, but is not willing to sort of stop that type of diet talk around a person, a partner who's recovering or a friend who's recovering or what have you. Do you have any sort of specific male specific ideas kind of for how to talk to men about this stuff? Is it kind of more generally how you would talk to anyone? Or are there any things that you find have come up for you in sort of cracking that code when talking to men?
Yeah, I think that's a much harder one. And like, I think what, here's what I'm going to use just like my own personal experience. And you know, a lot of my, I would say I have a subset of male friends who get what I do and really can sort of understand it. And, you know, we can talk about it and they can really identify with what this work means. And I have another group of friends that know what I do, but don't really get it. And so they, you know, they will be going on keto and they will be intermittent fasting and, you know, doing all this, all these fad diets, right? They will be doing all these things and we'll be hanging out. And I'm just, you know, they sort of know at this point that like, hey, I just don't want to talk about this with you. Like, this is not the topic that we're going to talk about. And I'm not going to comment on your weight either way, like wherever it goes. I don't want you to comment on mine either. And so like, let's just talk, if we can, let's just talk about other stuff. And because what you eat and the size of your body is like really so unimportant to me, I want to know about all the other stuff in your life. So for friends, it is harder. It's been hard for me to like maintain some of those friendships. It's harder to connect with them because in the end, it does create a little bit of a divide, obviously. I think what's really like the things that break my heart is when it is like a parent, it is a partner, it is someone like that's close to someone and they really, no matter how many times they've been told, can't get on board with some of this stuff. And I wish I had better advice for this, but I guess the sad part is some people are not going to change and we can't change everyone. And I think that's, I don't know if that's a cop out and I don't know if that's just.
No, I say that all the time too. It's really true. Like there's just some people who can't change, but it is really sad when it's someone you're close to, like a parent or family member, because it's like, what do you do then? You know, are you going to set that hard boundary of like, if you keep doing this, I can't have a relationship with you. And that's really painful.
Yeah. And especially when it comes to like family of origin versus family of choice, I think sometimes it's a really brave thing to do, to be able to say like, for me to continue to walk this path that is rebellious, right? That is counter the common narrative. Like I need support. I need safety. I need to know that the people around me are on board and have my back. And, you know, we set that boundary in a lot of other ways in our life. We really do. Like, I think around some topics, like we are very clear about, like, if you are going to believe these things, I'm not going to be very close to you right now. And it seems harder when it comes to weight and body, but I think it's a similar thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it seems harder because of how we're all socialized to think that weight and body is within our control and that it's like a personal failing if you can't shrink your body permanently or maintain some false ideal of health or whatever, and that it's like so difficult to explain to the person that you're setting the boundary with, probably, because if they can't hear you enough to like stop doing the diet talk or stop doing the fat phobic stuff, then they're probably not going to understand why you're setting this difficult boundary. And so it makes it that much harder in this particular arena.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think if you can do that and create a space for yourself where you don't have that influence in your life anymore constantly, it can be really healing too.
Incredibly.
So like you said, it's a very brave thing.
And so much of this work is, right? So much of this work is being really brave and being really challenging of the status quo.
Yeah, it's really tough work, and I'm glad you're doing it. I'm glad you have community in doing it too, because it is, like you said, having, you know, friends in real life or friends from back in the day, like, not everyone gets it. I'm very much in that boat too, you know. Have definitely that subset of friends who's like, okay, I don't understand it, but I'm going to go ahead and do this cleanse or whatever.
It's like, yeah. Ugh.
All right, just don't tell me about it, please. Like,
yeah, right.
Let's talk about anything but that. Ugh. I'm curious, you mentioned like keto and intermittent fasting and stuff, and I know those are pretty big trends, I think, across the board, but has there been anything, particular manifestations of diet culture that have come up for you in your work with men that you think are like more masculine specific ways that diet culture particularly targets men, or versions of diet culture that are more commonly adopted among men?
Yeah, no, sure. I think the biggest one is this idea of bulking up and building muscle mass and what you need to do it, and eating X amount of grams of protein versus cutting carbs and cheat days and putting your body into shock and, you know, working out so hard on these days. I mean, the reality is, I think if we took out gender and we took out any sort of personal identifiable information, and we said, this person is limiting their diet in these ways and compulsively exercising in these ways, we would be very quick to diagnose some sort of eating disorder behavior. But as soon as we put in weightlifting or, and men, we're like, oh, that's just healthy. Like, they're just going to the gym. They're just gym rats. But no, it's not. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things I see in men.
Yeah, that this sort of idea of like, it's healthy. And like a lot of the really toxic diet culture stuff, I think, has seeped out of gym culture into more popular culture. Like, clean eating was initially like a bodybuilder thing. And I think keto had its own weird history of like one specific medical context, but I think having it come out of that was maybe like a gym culture thing too. So like that gym culture really drives a lot of like mainstream diet culture, but especially when it first comes out before everyone else is doing it, it's sort of like, okay, well, this is what this guy needs to be doing to maintain his physique or maintain his fitness or whatever.
You know, and it's really like interesting if you sort of take a look at it. I mean, I've had the experience of sort of like being on a one-day conference with someone who was very prominent in this field, and the number of people who came up to him during the conference and was like, so exactly how many minutes after I eat should I eat this amount of protein, right? It was like exacting. It was like literally like this much per kilogram, and like after this much time and this much. I was blown away. I was like, really? You all are obsessing so much over like this minutia to build your muscle? It blew me away.
God, that's wild.
Yeah.
And we see that with people with diagnosed eating disorders, right? Like, yeah. It's bananas to me too, how like something that gets diagnosed in, you know, usually like a white emaciated woman, right? Cis woman, like that's the demographic that tends to get diagnosed the most with anorexia or with an eating disorder in general. And meanwhile, there are these buff tan gym rats, you know, of varying ethnicities probably that are doing all this wild stuff. And it's not even discussed. It's not even brought out as a possibility that actually this is really disordered.
No, I'm just following the science. Ugh. You know, no, I'm just following. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Quote unquote scientific. And it's that sort of like, I feel like that's the one of the patriarchal ways that like patriarchy shapes this too, right? As like this false idea that men are logical and rational and driven by intellect rather than emotions. And so like you get this sort of particularly masculine way of diet culture showing up where it's like looking at the science and like biohacking. That's one of those things that I've seen, right, a lot in like my male clients, you know, the sort of tech bro type milieu that they're in, right? Is like, how can I maximize my productivity by eating the right kinds of foods and cutting out certain foods and eating at certain times or in certain combinations? And it's that same sort of insistence on science and insistence on like, no, this is the way, which is funny because I find that a lot of times when people are insisting on science like that, they don't really know how to read research, actually. They're like people who are in totally different fields that weren't trained in how to read science. So they're just getting it secondhand of like, oh, here's a study. Like, look at these studies that support what, you know, whatever wackadoo diet is being, you know, prescribed. But they're not seeing like the patent flaws in the study, you know, that this was done in such a tiny population or such a population that's not generalizable at all, or that it was a 12-week study that only was followed up after a year. And we know that within 5 years is when we see, you know, diets failing. And so like, it's not long-term enough. You know, like people are just not asking those questions because they're not trained. And that's like a whole other thing is like that you have to be so educated to be able to interpret and read studies is kind of a problem. But they're nevertheless like not able to do that. And so they're just like, no, it's science, and holding so hard to that idea when that's not actually what the science says at all, or it's like really flawed science.
Yeah. Absolutely. And like that, yeah, this whole idea of like, I don't know, what do I need to hack to improve my efficiency? It's like, how about just like get some good night's sleep and like go to work really energized and do your best and you do what you can and then come home and rinse and repeat.
Right. And like eat enough food, maybe. Don't like try to restrict your food. Don't overexercise. Yeah. And also like don't expect yourself to be a machine. Don't work 12-hour days or 20-hour days, you know.
Like, and listen, we're not all going to be LeBron James. You know, like there's no way I was going to be an elite athlete. I played volleyball. I loved playing volleyball. I wanted to be 6'4 and left-handed. It wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a short Jewish fat kid from the West Side. Like I did as much as I could with what I had, and that's it.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's not possible to like hack your body into something that, you know, nor should it be. Like, you know, that's not your gift to bring the world. You have other things to offer.
Exactly.
And also maybe like basketball or volleyball or whatever you want to play is like fun for you. And that's great, but it doesn't have to be competitive and elite level.
Right. Yeah.
That's another thing too, I think, that's kind of like masculine specific, you know, of course, like athletics in general, I think pushes people into this, but I see this a lot too with masculine folks, that it's like the pressure to be competitive in whatever sport you do rather than just to do it for its own sake.
100%.
It's so fascinating, the sort of nuances of diet culture in different communities.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's, there are so many like different places to sort of go and discuss and like rabbit holes to dive into. And it's important because I think there are so many like different lived experiences when it comes to this work.
I'm really glad to talk to you for that reason, because I think this is going to be a great resource for people who, you know, for the men listening and also people who have men in their lives who are struggling, maybe to like get a little window into how this stuff works in, you know, diet culture specifically affects men and how they can help them. So thank you so much for being here. And can you tell us where people can find you and learn more about your work?
Yeah. So first off, I'm on all the social medias at Aaron Flores, RDN. And my website is, I did buy Smash the Weightriarchy. So you can find me at Smash the Weightriarchy. And then I also have a podcast called Dietitians Unplugged. Anywhere you get your podcast, you can log on and stream from there.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. You and Glenys do some amazing work there.
Thank you.
We'll definitely link to that in the show notes, and we'll link to all your other stuff too, so people can find you.
Yeah. And I'll be doing another men's group probably in September. Not sure when this episode will drop, but
probably in early September, actually. So
yeah, if you head over to my social media pages, you'll be able to get more information about it there.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aaron. It's such a pleasure to talk with you as always.
And thank you for having me. It's great. I have really great conversation. So thank you.
So that's our show. Thanks again so much to Aaron Flores for joining us on this episode. And thanks to you for listening. If you've gotten something out of this podcast, please help us reach more people who need to hear the anti-diet message by sharing this episode on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Sharing on one of the Apple platforms helps bring us up in the podcast rankings so that more people discover us and so that we can be an alternative to the pro-diet messages in that health category. You can find all the places to subscribe at ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. And if you leave us a nice rating and review in your podcast provider of choice, that is another way to help new listeners discover us. And I always very much appreciate hearing the nice reviews. If you're looking for some practical tips to help you get started on the anti-diet path for yourself, you can grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes from this episode, including all the resources we discussed, plus a full transcript, go to ChristyHarrison.com/204. That's ChristyHarrison.com/204. And to get the transcript, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and enter your email address. This episode was brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to make peace with food, break free from diet culture, and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up for the course at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. A big thanks to our editor and engineer, Mike Lalonde, our community and content associate, Kimmy Singh, and our administrative assistant, Julianne Watasik, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show every week. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography and designed by Meredith Noble, who I actually mentioned at the top of the show. And our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, stay psyched.